Thank you for tuning in to Movie Geeks United. This is an interview I conducted with actor Louis Gossett Jr. in 2020 for our Movie Geek Yearbook series. I never ended up airing the interview because the episode of that series was never produced, and unfortunately, the audio quality of our conversation wasn't the best. It was on a bad phone connection. But listening through it today, most of it is audible, especially if you put on your headphones and turn it up a bit. But on the occasion of his passing today, on March 29th, 2024, I felt it was important to finally share this conversation. He was a great actor and an even greater man. Here it is, Louis Gossett Jr.
There's no time for racism or enmity or any kind of conflict. The world is dying. And our number one job is to take better care of it. The job is up to us. So whatever parts I play or whatever the films that I do, I have to have that kind of philosophy.
Well, you came up in such an ideal time when you started making films in the late 60s on into the 70s, there was a feeling that a lot of the movies were truly engaging in the culture of the time.
Yeah.
And so do you feel that movies matter as much as they did then?
I think they matter more. But I think, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know which, such a people. And it's sometimes it's exploitation, which is probably one of the middle names of our entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. So they can do what they do. What I personally do is to try and find those roles that teach the next generation some kind of consciousness, which is the job of an elder, to make this planet and the mankind one step, one generation better than the one we have now. And it keeps happening. Besides, not just my movies alone, but many movies teach a lesson to the next generation about the responsibility of putting too much plastics in the ocean, making sure that there's the fish aren't full of plastics and not healthy, making sure that the plants we grow on the planet is from a replenished earth. That is our number one job. And we seem to be involved in who gets the most money, who has the most weapons, who's the strongest and who's the weakest. And we need one another unconditionally together to cooperate in our mutual salvation.
Absolutely.
So now it's a different ballgame now, because there's no winning a war or any kind of conflict. We have to leave that to the sports. Get those devils out of our system. The sports do it well. But for reality, we have to be together for our mutual salvation, which is the original lesson in the first place.
Well, and I think that film and art in general is such a direct way to break through someone's feeling of apathy.
Yes.
It's just like music. When music seeps into your soul in an instant, I feel the same way about film.
Well, it's the court jester. It's the messenger.
Yeah.
We have a very important role in society.
Let me talk to you about a couple of your roles that you played. You mentioned that you started in Broadway in Raisin in the Sun with Mr. Poirier.
No, I started earlier than that in Take a Giant Step in 1953 at the age of 17, still in high school. And it was a lead. Straight in high school that I grew up with, who turned out to be my English teacher. One of those original artists that ran from the blacklist. It was the Dalton Trumbos, how many people were there? There's so many. The Dalton Trumbos and the Elia Kazans and the Morris Karnofskis and the John Garfields. And so that society mirrored my society, post-depression people who couldn't do it by themselves. I came from a neighborhood, not a black neighborhood, but a complete diverse neighborhood. So my roots had to do with, if I came home and there was no food on my table, I could smell my way around the world. I could have dinner, I could have Jewish dinner, and have an Italian dinner, an Irish dinner, corned beef and cabbage, whatever. Whoever was available, we sat at the table and everybody ate. And before the cell phone, there were the elders, especially the women, looking at the women to make sure we behaved. It was a wonderful society. And the fruits of that wonderful society became the Arthur Millers, the Barbara Streisands, the Louis Gossett Jr.'s, the Jackie Robinsons, Ralph Bunche, all those particular people created the original artist's colony where I fitted. Mm. But we sat there, and then we went to Hollywood, and we started getting another kind of personality where somebody was better than the other.
But for you to have come up in that environment that cherished diversity as much as it did, it must have instilled in you a special fascination and appreciation of all kinds of different people.
Yes, it did. I refused to do the black exploitation because it carried with it a kind of anger, and it didn't do any service. The better service for me was those Iron Eagles and those Enemy Mines and those particular things that worked better. And it seems to have longevity, because every time I go someplace here in Georgia, people of all kinds take the time to take a picture. And, you know, the rule of an artist is one photograph is 10 tickets at the box office.
I like that.
And I take a lot of pictures because I can't separate myself of society I'm supposed to be representing.
Yeah. Let me ask you one question about your Raisin in the Sun experience. I'm wondering, as a performer, the shift between performing it on the stage and then translating it into a film performance, was that a process for you to become acclimated to?
Well, I learned from the best. I learned from the people in the actor studio and the people I work with. The Sidney Poitiers, the Diana Sands, the Ozzie Davis, the Ruby Dees, the Marlon Brandos, all of which we grew up poor together. James, Jimmy Dean at the actor studio. So we learned that process. The toughest process is to do it in person in front of 2,500 people in a theater, which is the pure. Now, to do television, that's another kind of technique we have to learn, because the screen is smaller. And then when you go to film, the screen is larger, so that you have to do less and make the same impression, if not more. So that's a study. Perhaps I might have to do a little course in some of these actors, because some of them are a little large for the screen. But it's a service, it's a selfless service.
Are you aware, when you do films, are you aware of camera placement and how to modulate your performance depending upon where it is in relation to you?
Well, now I'm internally aware of that, and I want to teach that to others. Sidney Poitier taught me, I don't know if he realizes, he taught me how to dance with the camera. Mm. He was an artist. He knew how to dance with the camera and be in a certain place when you're making the moment, the points that are relevant for the story. You could always see him in an indelible position in whenever he did that. But people got it. So I copy and represent those Sidney Poitiers, those Marlon Brandos. Anthony Quinn would be best. And there was a teacher from the actor studio put in the Caribbean and really never did a black character. His name was Frank Silvera. And on Broadway, he played Ben Gazzara, Anthony Francioso's father. He played the General Huerta in Viva Zapata, and he played the chief in the Malambrano Mutiny on the Bounty, and he was my teacher. So I give him all kinds of blessings and all kinds of kudos for teaching me the difference of theater, television, and film.
Mm. You know, but the journey of an artist to hone their craft is also, I find, a journey into yourself. And
yes, it is.
Defining who you are.
Yeah, because especially in movies, when they have a magnifying glass to look at your eyes and your expressions, you have to have an internal, flawless, but you have to have an internal resolution, so that when they get a close-up and it goes into the editing room, the editor can't do anything but put that on the screen.
Yeah. You worked with a filmmaker and I think his first film that he directed that is one of my favorites, and that's Hal Ashby.
That's a good friend. Very good friend. He got his Oscar for doing the editing of The Heat of the Night by Norman Jewison. And Hal called me, and we kind of hung out together. That was a genius. He was a genius. Mm-hmm. He wasn't ready for Hollywood, but he was really ready for film.
There was such a humanism to his work. And he's one of the filmmakers that I find, gosh, we need his movies now more than ever.
Remember Harold and Maude?
Mm, yes. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I had a ball. I was home. I got a chance to go back home and do some great work There's a very funny moment that Bo Bridges will tell you about. Was a scene where we're chasing him out of the black neighborhood. And we're all chasing him, boys running, and the entire neighborhood, black neighborhood of Brooklyn, "Can I help you, Lou?" And they started getting after Bo. And I had to stop and put my arm around Bo Bridges and say, "This is just a movie."
Do you have what are the most vivid memories from the filming of Skin Game that you carry with you?
Oh, well, the relationship between me and James Gunn, which were two brothers. He's a Cherokee and I was black. And he saw me in the theater. He wanted to work with me, and I always wanted to work with him. So some of those moments that could have been very sensitive, controversial, kind of overshadowed because we were two brothers taking advantage of a bad social disease, racism. So all those moments, especially the one where they caught us, was quite honest and quite beautiful.
Yeah, and it's a surprising movie because you don't expect a con man comedy to kind of intermingle with issues of slavery. It's an unusual movie.
Yeah, but you take Maverick, you take Jim Garner thing, and he makes you laugh at something quite ridiculous. I love that man. I miss him terribly.
He was such a genuine, authentic presence, stabilizing presence in everything he did.
Yeah, he was one of the best.
Is there a film you did from, especially from the period of the 70s, that you feel has been unjustly overlooked or under the radar?
In the 70s, let's see. There were a couple of them. One was called J.D.'s Revenge with Glenn Turman.
Hmm.
And then there was a Lawman Without a Gun about the first black sheriff in Mississippi. There were a couple of them that I wish that had come back, but it's okay. It's just a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and you never know the formula. It could be the time something's released. It could be the wrong marketing campaign. It's a miracle when movies hit at any time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very miracle that Skin Game didn't get much publicity. But you know, what's a better example? Enemy Mine. That was Academy Award time. But it just happened to have, when Marvin Davis bought all the stuff from Robert Evans, he took 22 movies and put it out between December 1st and December 22nd. And Enemy Mine was one of them. And didn't get its just desserts until it got into cable. That was when cable was being born. And that's when we got our reputation. But that was a movie that should have won, or should have been up for many Academy Awards.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a couple of questions about that film, because I love it. I remember as a teenager, my mother taking me to that movie, and I fell in love with it from first viewing. It's an unusual role because, whereas in a movie like Officer and Gentleman or Iron Eagle or what have you, you might have a model that you can mold the character around. Mm-hmm. But this is like pure imagination. You had to start from scratch on this character.
Absolutely. You just took the words out of my mouth. I had to start from scratch and create a society, a belief system. Ironically, the one we need today is the one that Drac had. And every now and then you say, Dennis Quaid, you say, well, if you don't, at first you don't succeed, you try again. And I get amazed. I say, that's our religion. We find out how much similarities we have. In every living creature on this planet, we are connected with some kind of master plan that we have to obey to rather than try and create it and change it. It's a humble approach, very humble and receptive approach of a divine force, especially as an artist, so that it's an honest relationship with some divine force. So that when you react to those moments, they're organic and people get touched, whether they like it or not.
Mm. And in that film, as you mentioned, it's pretty much a two-hander between you and Mr. Quaid. And I'm wondering, when you share such exclusive screen time with one other person throughout the duration of much of the movie, tell me about that relationship actor with actor on that film.
Well, we had to be so honest. I did one like that called The Blood Knot in theater. And when you have to be so honest, you rub each other the wrong way sometimes, and sometimes you rub each other the right way. But you have to be honest without covering it up. The relationship, and that's how relationships sometimes start. So Dennis Quaid had a ball because he was the star of the movie from time to time. I think he'd get a team and go out to the discotheque and date. And I had to get to make up at 3 o'clock in the morning because it's a five. So all of that it translates on the screen, and obviously it ends up at two brothers.
I know there's not one way to work, but it seems like a character like that would in some regards be an outside in kind of thing, because I would think that costume, that makeup would make up a lot of the character from movement and that sort of thing.
Well, the toughest, and I did it before, I also went blind for about 10 days. The toughest is for that man to be part serpent, and serpents don't blink. Mm. And two sets of contact lenses in, and I had to act like that serpent, and the makeup kind of helped me because I couldn't blink because it was too painful. So I had to create something that made it natural for me not to blink, and maybe made it natural for me to be able to do other things and not do others. So it was a challenge. I call it the tribute to Lon Chaney Sr.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. That makeup. All the actors turned it down because there was no way they could see your eyes or your face. Couldn't see you. That's a challenge to me. I loved it.
But it also calls upon it. It requires a kind of enhanced physicality too. I mean, you have to find different means of expression if they can't see you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it worked. Some of the things I learned from Sidney Poitier and others, it worked. Whether you have makeup or not, it worked. Another favorite person is Dustin Hoffman. I liked him in so many things. Mm. He's an organically brilliant man.
I talk to a lot of actors, and I find that when they first start out, a lot of them say that they feel a need to, when they're preparing, to try to throw in everything and the kitchen sink. And as the years go by, they refine, and they have a better sense of, you know, what do I absolutely need to invest this character in truth?
Well, you got my explanation. It's the major word in an acting class. It's called selectivity. Now that you have your instrument fine enough so that you can make it larger or smaller, you have to have the art of selectivity, of what you want to highlight to make the point. Make the point on theater. Make the point on the television camera and make the point in the movie camera. There's a selectivity involved. And sometimes that selectivity makes us very riveting or boring, depending on our selectivity.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if there are moments when you're crafting a performance, like for instance, let's take Officer and a Gentleman. Was there a moment or an epiphany you had that all of a sudden that character came into perfect view for you?
The first thing that they did was that first scene, the first scene you see me in the movie. That's the first thing we shot. We rehearsed it, and so some of the social mores were there with all of the actors. So the more intense and overwhelming I got, the more they giggled. So the Marine stepped in, and Tyler said, they gave me... They moved me out of the location 20 miles away, and they did something with those actors. And when it came back, they were behaving themselves, because originally they were laughing at me. Hmm. So Marines said, if you're going to do stuff about the Marines, it has to be real. So then what we did in basic training, reality is a reality, and we have to get your attention. So now, if those actors won't give him attention, they'll give us the attention. So whatever they did, they got the attention. So I'm very grateful to the Marines. They should have the Oscar, not me. And also those actors, those Tony Planners, those guys, they behaved themselves. And we came up with a diamond.
Would you really, between Officer and a Gentleman and the Iron Eagle franchise, which was extraordinarily successful for you, you've really placed military figures in a terrific, honorable light. And you didn't come from a military family, did you?
No, but I have a military experience. But fortunately, it was between Korea and Vietnam. Mm. So I was chosen, a bunch of us, we were chosen to do all the training films after Korea, especially the brainwashing. So I did it was called Men at War. It was almost nominated, but I had to do all the stuff, every branch of the service between Korea and Vietnam. So I jumped out of planes. I was a frogman. Did all the basics, film for the new recruits that went into Vietnam. So I was really, really trained by the Green Berets. And I have a military discipline almost up to then. So that, ironically, this month, I'm going to go in the United States Marine Hall of Fame. I was never a Marine.
Oh, wow.
But they're going to put me in the Hall of Fame. The graduate service I serviced was the Green Berets, which is probably the same philosophy. But it's always been a military discipline in my system since then.
What a great honor.
That is a great honor. And if it wasn't for the Marines and all the embassies and all the places I've been in the world, I'm not sure whether I'd be alive. I was able to go to Israel and do a film after the Six-Day War. And then I was able to go to Israel after the Sadat. So I don't really need a passport to go there. But there's something very spiritual about the lightning in the bottle things that have happened in my life, which I'm extremely grateful for.
Yeah. When you played Sadat, when you got that script, it had to have felt extremely daunting.
Very daunting, because I came from almost a predominantly Jewish society. But the more I read about it, the more it was apropos for that man to go through the changes he went through from a warrior who hated the Jews to one who wanted peace because he lost his brother and his best friend. And he just does that transition in that movie.
Mm.
So it was very strange, because deep down there's still an enmity between the Jew and the Arab, and some people did not like the movie, but they couldn't help from having it in their home. So Sadat is in almost every home in the Middle East, even today, and the person who got the best results from it is myself playing Anwar Sadat.
Yeah, what a transformative leader.
Once again, there's that philosophy again. We can't survive without one another. War is old. It'll destroy. You shoot a person, you shoot yourself. We need each other for a mutual salvation.
Yeah, and I think, if anything, art is about connection and communication. And I think that's what we need now more than ever.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now more than ever.
Let me ask you about Roots in this sense, because I think you could do all the movies in the world, and you've done several that have really hit the zeitgeist. But until you've become a phenomenon on television, that's kind of a whole different league of relatability and that comes from that, where people truly, you're in their homes.
Yeah.
Tell me about that experience and how you've experienced in your own life the echoes of Roots.
Well, one of the main echoes of Roots and other films, is I was doing a thing called Happen Leonard. It was a television series. Mm. And it was the beginning of the film industry coming to Georgia. So all little small Georgia towns had an experience in the past of terrible atrocities, racial atrocities. Now the money is coming to the state, and so every small town looks like a back lot from Hollywood. I mean, all the lights work, and you feel that if you went through a door, you'd see nothing but a wall, like a studio. But the towns were at their best. So this one night, night watchman was watching the set. I think it was a double or triple job, but anyway, he was asleep in his car, and he wouldn't wake up, and they shot him in the hand. So I refused to go to that town. So whatever they did, they made it okay. So I went, and the sheriff of that tribe, a big, tall, blue-eyed man with a stern face, but at my height, 6'4", maybe taller. And I got out of the car, and he stopped what he's doing for all of his staff, and he riveted his eyes on me. And I got out, and I riveted my eyes on him, and I walked straight to him. And he looked at me. If he had a weapon, it seemed like he might have shot me. I stepped on my hand and shook his hand. And the first thing out of his mouth was, he said, "Boy, you know, you've been in every room in my house." I said, "What do you mean?" "I've seen every one of your movies. Sometimes it was in the bathroom, sometimes it was in the bedroom, but you're in my house. So I'd like for you to come and have some lunch so that the real person can come in the house." That man was probably a member of the Ku Klux Klan, but it penetrated. sir. We looked at each other and shook each other's hand. That's what we need.
Yeah. That's the unifying power.
Yeah. Another example of that was in South Africa. When I would not go until Mandela came out. And so I got kind of enamored by the American Negro, the African National Conference. And Oliver Tambo was the godfather of the ANC while Mandela was inside. And now Mandela is out, and I'm doing a movie called, we produced it, it's called Inside. And so I became friends with the Tambo. There was and I was dating one of the nieces, and the man, I'm getting old. He was going to be second in command after Mandela stepped down from being president. And he came out of his house and they shot him in the chest 6 times. Now, what I learned, so when somebody does that, you get the flowers, the wreath, and you get in your car and you go to the house and you deliver them. That's all I was thinking about. Me and my assistant went to his house. Chris Hani is his name, H-A-N-I. And so I came to the house, and before we looked up, we were surrounded by people who were about to kill one another, the white soldiers and the black kids. It got quiet. It was like a scene from an Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Birds. It was such quiet. I couldn't back out, so I grabbed the flowers and got out of the car and started walking toward the house. And they separated. I got into the house, and my friend Dolly Thomas said, "You're crazy. What are you doing here?" I said, I wasn't thinking. I just wanted to bring flowers to Mrs. Honey. So they led me to Mrs. Honey. And they were doing some kind of ritual where she was in the sheets and stuff, and they had washed dirt away from her. And she looked at me, and I said, "This is for you." And I put it down and I walked in, thinking I was going to go out. I couldn't, because they were there getting ready to confront one another. Mm. I spent 4 hours there. And then finally, Mrs. Tambo, the godmother of ANC, went out and spoken like this much, three, maybe four languages. And she really sounded very involved. She was in tears. So she came back after about 3 hours of speaking and exhausted. She says, "I think she can go now." So I went out, you know, here's pin drop, got in the car, got in the freeway, back to the hotel. And we were followed by the helicopters for a while, then they pulled away. And that was one thing. So now my second time I'm there is a good man in Africa. We land in Johannesburg, and these two larger-than-life white men, blonde, asked for me. So the first one off, I said, "Man, I should not have come back here." So they pulled me out, found my luggage, put me in a car, and took me straight to the hotel. The man who was in charge of taking care of me was a soldier that day when I went to the Honey household. And what happened is that the man said, "Put him in your eyesight and shoot when I tell you to shoot." So they followed me all the way to that house. And nothing happened. And he said, "The reason why nothing happened," he said, "hold a minute, wait a minute. That's Louis Gossett Jr. from the Hollywood." I'd been officer general already. For some reason, he decided not to shoot me. That is my best friend in South Africa.
Wow.
That soldier.
So you can honestly say that the movie saved your life.
The movie saved my life in many ways and enhanced relationships.
Mm.
That is our responsibility.
That's beautiful. You know, I'm thinking about roots. One of the things I love.
Two stories. So the man from South Africa and that man from a little town in Georgia.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about movies is their communication. They communicate with each other. So a movie you see today might be communicating with a film made 50, 60 years ago. And by that same token, a movie like Roots, you are communicating with your ancestry. Felt like such a sacred set.
It was very sacred set because I had people, it's very ironic that our elders live longer than we do. So I was raised by my great grandmama, and I have a photograph of me and her. She lived approximately 115, maybe longer. She was busy raising me and my cousins while our parents had jobs as chauffeurs, porters, and maids, and butlers. So the elders took care of the young. So I had the experience of giving her a tribute during Roots and my grandparents. I always thought I'd make people giggle because my great grandmother only lied to me one time. They said, "What was that?" She said, "This is going to hurt me more than going to hurt you."
Yeah, I think I've heard that myself several times. When my mother had me pull my own switch from the front yard.
Yeah.
I want to ask another kind of geeky acting question because the craft fascinates me. There are actors, and I'm no professional actor, but I've done a lot of plays in my life, and I always hear about the moment of transcendence that you reach for as an actor. And I think I've experienced it once, but it's that moment where anything that's around you, you kind of feel like you're levitating and you are truly one with that moment. And I'm wondering, are those few and far between in the film medium? I would think they're more common.
It's the same in the film medium. One in Roots, when me and Alex Haley would meet, as we go to speak after the result of Roots, Alex would be going to one place and I'd be going to another. We meet at the airport. And one thing he always mentioned was that scene when I personally pulled LeVar Burton in because he was straight out of SC. Because he was Kunta Kinte and he's also LeVar Burton. Mm-hmm. So I got to know this young man, this brilliant young man. And there's a scene in it where he's beaten. So that Vic Morrow, my best friend at the time, he came up to me and apologized before he did the scene. I didn't know what he was talking about. But I'm sorry, I'm watching Vic Morrow order a whipping of LeVar Burton, or that man ordering a whipping of Kunta Kinte. He wants him to say, "Your name is no longer Kunta Kinte, your name is Toby." So I watched and watched. I didn't have to prepare anything at the time. And then finally, they cut him down because he said, "Yes, my name is Toby." So I'm washing his wrists. I'm looking at Vic Morrow. I'm also fiddler looking at that man. And the last line in the script is, "Don't you care what that white man calls you. Kunta Kinte, that's who you are. That's what you always be. You hear me?" That's the end of the script. And something happened, one of those moments you mentioned. I looked at Vic Morrow and I said, "There's going to be another day." You hear me? There's going to be another day. And Alex Haley said he should have written it himself, but it was perfect. So those moments happen a great deal. And we don't remember, we don't forget them.
Yeah.
We don't forget them. There's moments in Iron Eagle like that. There's definitely moments in Enemy Mine. And, of course, definitely moments in Sadat.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do that, you know that's what God put you in the right profession.
You know, this my last question for you. The series that we're doing, we're not only exploring a lot of the works of various artists, we're also asking them about what works mean the most to them through the years. And we're starting in the decade of the 70s. So is there a film from the 70s that is not one of your own that means the most to you?
There are quite a few. The James Dean's, every one of James Dean's movies.
Mm.
Especially the, what was it called, with Raymond Burr, Julie Harris, John Steinbeck movie.
Giant?
No, but that was one moment that he did beautifully, but it was about...
Oh, East of Eden.
East of Eden, yes, sir. It sticks out because of those performances, especially James Dean's. And there are others like that. There's the Western with Montgomery Clift and John Wayne. Something pulled me away from being in the audience and participating in that the experience of those actors and those actresses. There's a few, but those are the ones I think about right away.
Yeah.
Being Marlon Brando and Mutiny on the Bounty.
Hmm.
There's some stuff that you can't act. He had those moments when he had that fight with the captain. It's just amazing, amazing stuff.
What did Brando do? Because it's a bit of an enigma. He seemed to have there was no not existing in the moment. There was just the moment. It seemed
the moment. Brando, and I put it, Brando and Sir Laurence Olivier in the same box. Mm. They transcended acting. They transcended the art. They've lost themselves into the characters. They have so many moments. James Dean is another. That's so many moments that you know you weren't acting. You transcend that thing. And moments.
The term acting itself, I mean, it kind of feels, it feels like I'm going to put on a show. But film acting is really behavior. It's really more precise than that.
That's a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
Trust your inner feelings, because that camera will find it.
Mr. Gossett, my friend, you are an absolute delight to talk to. I cherish this conversation. So thank you very much.